My name is Scott Challoner, and you are listening to the Leaders' Council podcast for the people who run the country and the people who keep the country running. As our regular listeners will know very well, part of our mission here at the Leaders' Council is to bring you a variety of distinct perspectives on leadership. And as we record this podcast on September the 13th, 2022, we mourn the passing of one of our most incredible and most loved leaders, Her Late Majesty the Queen, who served our country with such steadfastness and devotion for the entirety of her life. And we also say God save the King to her successor and our new sovereign, and wish him all the best, King Charles III. Joining me on today's programme is Mark Howitt, the Chief Technical Officer and founder at Store Electric, a business which is developing widely applicable and cost-effective energy storage technologies to help enable renewable sources to power the globe. And given the topical matters and issues around energy security and the net zero agenda at this present time, I believe this is going to be a very relevant conversation indeed. Mark, very warm welcome to you today, and by all means, thank you for joining us on the programme. It's a real pleasure having you with us.
And thank you, Scott, for having me.
It's an immense pleasure, Mark. Now, I've only given a very vague background of Store Electric, your business, and what it is that you do. So in your own words, just for those listeners tuning in that might not be familiar with you, what is it that you would say that your business does and is certainly aiming to be doing at this point in time?
Well, we're seeking to enable renewables to power the world. And the energy transition, as far as I can see it, is something that's exceedingly simple. Far too many people complicate it and find all sorts of byways and dead ends to follow in terms of how to achieve the energy transition. It's basically very simple. We're replacing hydrocarbons with renewables and net zero generation. That means that any replacement's got to be on the scale of hydrocarbons. So anything that's on very small scale is merely tickling the edges of the problem. It's contributing to the solution, but it's not going to be the major part. The same applies to duration. If it can't last for as long as the hydrocarbons, the power stations and such like, then again, you're helping with the solution, but only tickling the edges of it. I believe that the energy transition is going to replace fossil fuels with essentially electricity and hydrogen and derivatives of them, such as synthetic fuels and chemicals. And so we're addressing both of those two points, and we find that addressing the two is very synergistic because hydrogen is made by electricity, but it hates intermittency. So we can take out the intermittency of electricity to make the hydrogen side of the economy much more efficient and effective. And likewise, our storage methods for large-scale, long-duration electricity are the best storage methods also for large-scale, long-duration hydrogen. So we're essentially addressing the biggest issues of the energy transition.
It's very interesting, isn't it? And what we're looking at here as well is the fact that, you know, the energy transition, the urgency of that has certainly been hastened in recent months. And that's not just because of our carbon targets. Of course, the UK government is legally bound to aim for that goal of net zero carbon emissions by 2050. But also with what we're happening in what's happening in Eastern Europe, of course, and the issue around energy security because of reliance on oil and gas supplies from other countries, we need to make sure that we have a robust domestic energy supply. The new Prime Minister, of course, Liz Truss, her plans for that in the short term are to initiate further fracking, of course, North Sea oil and gas exploration. But in the longer run, do you feel this is really going to be a sustainable answer?
No, I certainly don't. In some ways, it's exceedingly frustrating because I've actually been talking with the ministers and government officials and the grid since 2016 about the energy security issue. 2018, I did a survey of all our neighboring countries' energy transition plans. By 2040, every single one of them, except Norway and Iceland and possibly Switzerland, are planning to be importing during times of system stress, importing electricity. But those times of system stress, such as after sunset on a windless winter evening, occur simultaneously across most of the continent. So if everyone's importing simultaneously, who's exporting? And I've been pointing out that that means that we cannot rely on imports through interconnectors for actual demand or for our supply margin. And yet, since 2019, we've been doing just that. We've only been saved by the fact that our neighboring countries and ourselves have not decarbonized as fast as we should have been doing and closing the power stations. So I've been saying that that's going to happen. They've been blithely saying that, look, interconnectors will have contracts in place and our neighbors will export, to which I've replied, can you envisage any transmission operator anywhere in Europe telling their government that they exported that a blackout in a certain city was because they were exporting the electricity that it needed? Mm. I can't envisage that happening. So that gives them a legal imperative to cut us off. And Brexit actually gives them an even stronger legal imperative because we're no longer classified as an internal market. We're classified as an export market. And the same applies for gas. And the Ukraine crisis actually meant that due to a shortage of gas on the continent, they cut off our imports from gas. And the electricity connectors, most particularly the one to France, reversed their direction so that we're exporting, not importing, which proves bittersweet what I've been telling them for 6 years. Yes, we do need to address the problem. There are issues, urgent issues that need addressing. Yes, we do need to address them urgently, but it is not the strategic solution. It will not stop the warming of the planet. And some of these actions are counterproductive because they're creating assets that will last between 20 and 60 years. And it's very difficult to close a new asset well within its amortization life, especially when the government itself has encouraged the construction of that asset and will therefore, at least morally, bear some responsibility for its financial losses if closed early. So it's creating too much of a constituency to support fossil fuel. There are other strategies that would have worked, but unfortunately, most of them are a rather longer lead time than some of these actions that the governments are talking about. Increasing the output of existing fields, yes, that's a short lead time one that doesn't create such new assets. But going in wholeheartedly into fracking does create such assets. I don't like it.
And alongside fracking as well, I mean, there has been a lot of headlines around Hinkley Point C as well and rolling out more nuclear power. What are your thoughts around that side of things? Because there has been some vehement opposition locally to that, certainly.
Well, let me make it clear that nuclear power reduces the need for large-scale, long-duration energy storage in both hydrogen and electricity. So what I'm about to say is against my interests, commercial interests. I believe in nuclear power. I believe that it is a lot cheaper than most people think because we don't pay for the value of electricity, we pay for its price. What I mean by that is electricity gets paid the same per megawatt hour whether it's base load, dispatchable, or intermittent. But if it's intermittent, it needs the balancing services to be added to the cost of running the entire system. So it's much more valuable if it's base load or dispatchable meaning available on demand. So in addition to which, it's paid the same whether it's synchronous or asynchronous. Now, what does that matter? A synchronous plant is one with large rotating machines. It has natural inertia. It delivers all kinds of benefits, such as reactive power and load, stability, power quality, system recovery and resilience, and all of those services that if you're powering the grid with intermittent sources, you don't get them and you have to procure them separately. So if we were to pay for the quality of the electricity as much as the quantity, I believe nuclear power stations would be cheap. I also believe that they're safe. The only accidents have been when when the people in charge have absolutely refused point blank to listen to regulators screaming, no, you don't do it that way, you should do it the proper way, and where there's been regulatory capture. As long as we ensure that there's no regulatory capture or such corruption, I believe that the nuclear industry is very safe. And that applies both to large and small modular reactors.
Absolutely. And you say, of course, it is sort of against your own commercial interests. And that's because, of course, what Storelectric is involved with is the compressed air energy storage method, isn't it? Using technologies that are out there at the moment at a grid scale, both efficiently and in a cost-effective manner. And it's staggering, isn't it, that this technology has existed since the late 1970s and has sort of expanded throughout the 1990s as well, when it was taken to the USA. And this isn't being rolled out on a bigger scale yet, is it? Why do you think that is? Because this, to me, looks as if, you know, we've got a real solution there in waiting here to sort of help facilitate that green transformation.
Oh, yes. The German plant in the compressed air energy storage is very well proved. It's clean, it's responsive, it doesn't harm the environment, it's the perfect solution. But the technologies that were rolled out in the Hundorf plant in 1978 and the McIntosh plant in 1991, that was old technology. We're light years ahead of that. So the Hundorf plant was, with compressed air energy storage, you're essentially using surplus or cheap electricity to compress air, which you store underground. When you need the electricity again, you let it out, blow a turbine, and regenerate the electricity. That's the simple bit. That's the really well-proven bit. The challenge is what you do with the heat. Because when you compress air up to a typical 70 bar of pressure, that's about 30 times the pressure of your car tire, you heat it up to somewhere north of 650 Celsius. And because you're doing so intermittently and when the energy price is low, it's not saleable heat. So therefore, both of those plants waste the heat of compression up a cooling tower, because you've got to cool the air before you store it down to close to ambient temperature. When you come to expand it from 70 bar, it cools down to somewhere south of minus 150 Celsius, and that would freeze and destroy both the plant and the environment. So you've got to put back in the heat of expansion. Both of those plants burn gas to do so. We've got a technology that does that much more efficiently, but it's also dual fuel and will burn hydrogen and therefore decarbonizes the gas grid, decarbonizes. But the other technology we have on compressed air energy storage, it takes the heat of compression, stores it separately, and puts it back in during expansion. So where is the round-trip efficiency? And I'm talking electricity out to all energy in. The round-trip efficiency of Hundorf is 42%. McIntosh is 50%. Modern versions of McIntosh that are being promoted and things like that are 52 to 54%. I think towards the bottom end of that, because they talk terminal to terminal, not grid to grid. Our adiabatic compressed air energy storage, which we call GreenCase, is 68 to 70%. At scale. Now, that's more efficient than batteries, lifetime average grid to grid. It's virtually as efficient as pumped hydro, but a fraction of the cost and far more readily available locations, and you don't have to flood two valleys in doing it. So, yes, it's been well proven for well over 40 years, and both those plants are still operating and profitable. But it's light years ahead of them in terms of technology.
And that's the key part, isn't it? Because if this can become a more efficient solution, I mean, it's like, and you also mentioned the affordability of it. Those are sort of the key elements of shoring up our energy supply, isn't it? It needs to be affordable. it needs to be reliable and it needs to be resilient. And the affordable side of it certainly is going to mean a lot to a great many people out there at the moment, given the well-documented rise in energy costs, given what is going on around the world at this point in time.
Very much so. And our levelized cost of electricity is where batteries aspire to be in the mid-2030s. And it's already there. And so, and then we'll improve from there. We cannot make the energy transition unaffordable. And it's not just in terms of providing the balancing services. We provide, although the levelized cost of electricity is less than a third of that of batteries, we're also providing all these other services that I spoke about from synchronous plants. And therefore, each one of our plants can deliver concurrently a range of services that would require between four and six batteries to deliver. This is transformationally improving the energy transition, its costs, its effectiveness, its reliability, its resilience. And so it's a tremendous opportunity. And it's immensely frustrating that that we've had verbal expressions of interest from around the world. Scores of businesses around the world have expressed interest in building follow-on plants. Need to get that first one built. And yet that first one itself will already have EPC guarantees for the first of a kind from Mitsubishi, which is almost unheard of to get one for the first of a kind, and tells you an awful lot about how low the technical risk is. It's been validated by Mitsubishi, Siemens, Arup, Costain, Fortum, Mott MacDonald, Fortum O'Neill, among others. These are not small outfits. These are some of the world's greatest engineering and energy companies. And they know what they're saying when they're validating it. And every single one of them says effectively that it does what we claim it does and will do so from day one. And not only from day one, but using existing equipment. So we're not tied to any suppliers. We're not going to have to put up prices because we're held to ransom by one particular manufacturer. And we can do so at an unprecedentedly wide variety of configurations, sizes, air storage pressures, and all that sort of thing. So it's more configurable than any version ever.
It certainly seems so, doesn't it? And, you know, it almost seems as if it's been given a vote of confidence abroad by so many businesses that you've talked about there that aren't small, that are really out there in the market, and yet it's something that ministers just don't seem to be sort of cottoning onto. And I struggle to sort of understand perhaps sort of why that is. And given the sort of strategies that they're currently outlining, it seems as if they're acknowledging a need to shore up energy security in the short term, given what is going on globally. But that could almost come as a compromise, because we could be forsaking our sort of carbon goals as a result of that, couldn't we?
I agree wholeheartedly, and it isn't just a confirmation from abroad. Most of those companies confirmed it in the UK. The issue is that you can't build it small. The smallest we can build is 40 megawatts. That's enough to power a town of 50,000 people for 4 or 5 hours. So that's the smallest we can do, and we go up to multiple gigawatts. The issue is that, and the lead time, because it's a significantly long lead time to build these plants, which frankly is mostly due to the time that it takes to get the grid connection, but it would still be a multi-year lead time. And they like knee-jerk solutions far too often that are basically quick fixes and patches rather than solving the problem. But one would hope that they come round to it now, because if they're talking about developing other oil fields, gas fields, fracking and that sort of thing, those are long lead time items as well. So are new wind farms. Mm. We're in the same order of lead time as those. So why not do the compressed air energy storage simultaneously rather than just relying on, any storage, any balancing stuff, we need to be done before the end of the year, which is what we've been doing for the last decade. I mean, frankly, 10 years ago, and well, the country's most intergovernmental report ever, the Technology Innovation Needs Analysis, known as TINA, said that they needed up to 57.4 gigawatts of new storage in the UK with an average duration of 5 hours. In that decade, we have built not a single megawatt. That's because we've been going for the quick fixes, the easy wins, the low-hanging fruit, and ignoring the strategic. We need to address the strategic issues. Otherwise, I believe that the energy transition will be unaffordable, unreliable, and fragile. But I believe that with us, the energy transition will be affordable, reliable, and resilient.
This is exactly it, isn't it? The short-term fixes are not going to be the long-term solution, and we need to certainly start looking at long-term solutions. And it's important as well that you did sort of mention the lead time on wind farms as well, because I suppose something that the former Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, talked an awful lot about is the bureaucracy involved in sort of building an onshore wind farm and the planning behind that and how sort of lengthy that process is. Do you think that your technologies are perhaps maybe being hampered by the same sorts of regulations at this point in time, or is it more the fact that ministers simply haven't cottoned onto it?
It's hampered by an equivalent bureaucracy, but not in terms of planning and things like that. The planning's relatively easy. The equivalent bureaucracy is in terms of the grid infrastructure, because it takes a long time, 7 to 10 years, to get a new transmission grid connection. And the grid is not building ahead of need. It's building to need, which has basically impeded the energy transition up till now and is becoming an ever-increasing impediment. What is more, the grid themselves have shown that every new gigawatt of offshore wind requires, if you include all the balancing, stability, and other services, 1.5 to 1.75 billion pounds worth of grid reinforcement, and about a tenth of that every year till kingdom come in terms of operation, maintenance, and finance costs. Now, if you were to connect those wind farms through our storage to the grid, it needs a half-size grid connection. One could even connect a new wind farm through the existing grid connection of the old wind farm. And so this will avoid the need that many forecasters put out of tripling or more the size of the grid. And so from the infrastructure viewpoint too, we can make the energy transition much more affordable and much better. And you can put in place the right incentives so that the grid gains more from working with such projects and not building grid than it does from building and thereafter maintaining the grid. So it can be structured so that they gain more from doing that than from just blithely going ahead and building more and more infrastructure, more and more transmission lines and interconnectors as they are currently planning to do.
It's quite interesting, isn't it, that when you sort of delve so deeply into this topic, you find that it goes down to the baseline, doesn't it, that even the grid itself is being reactive to the needs of the country rather than proactive and planning ahead. And that seems to be something that's all encompassing across our entire energy strategy. I mean, we're being reactive and we're looking for the short-term fixes to cater to existing need, and we're not thinking long-term, we're not thinking strategically. And if we don't change the course now, that's going to essentially come and bite us back, isn't it?
Yes, and it's not just that we're not thinking strategically, we're also not thinking holistically. We're not thinking about the whole breadth of the problem. What I've outlined is something that will address the energy balancing, the stability services, the power quality needs, the grid construction requirements, the connection of renewables. It also addresses the decarbonisation of the gas grid because it removes the intermittency before the electrolyzers and therefore makes the electrolyzers much more efficient, much more cost-effective, and longer-lived. And so it's the integrated thinking that we're also missing in what we tend to be doing is addressing one micro sub issue at a time. Basically, we're addressing all the symptoms of the energy transition instead of addressing the causes. So we procure, for example, inertia separately from reactive power, separately from balancing, whereas a plant of our sort can't deliver them separately. We deliver them all together concurrently from the same equipment, much more efficiently and cost effectively. Addressing them all separately will alleviate the symptoms while the main problems continue to build up. What we're doing is addressing the entire issue.
And that is exactly what needs to be done in the longer run. Address the exact issue. Don't just treat the symptoms, treat the cause. And, you know, it's a shame, actually, Mark, that we're starting to run short of time on the programme this morning, because it's an incredibly compelling conversation. I'd certainly love to welcome you back on the show in future to talk about this further and sort of catch up on sort of how your technology is developing. But just before we do wrap up today, if we look ahead maybe sort of to the next sort of 12 months from here, what is it that you're sort of aiming to perhaps achieve with the technology that you have, and where would you like to see the UK's energy strategy going within that period of time under this new government that we now have?
Well, up till now, owners of existing salt caverns have been playing hard to get for quite often some quite unaccountable reasons. But some of them are starting to come round, and we are in negotiations with existing salt cavern owners, also locations for making new salt caverns at a very large scale. So within the next year, we anticipate having a number of locations secured and a number of projects starting out in both compressed air and hydrogen and mix and match of the various technologies. We've got the support already of wind farm operators, of engineering companies, of equipment suppliers, of planning and environmental businesses. We've got support, very, very broad support. And also we've got letters of intent for funding. One of the letters actually specifies €500 million of funding as being available. And verbally, they say, "Well, it'll go as big as the business plan can justify." So we're putting everything in place, and we expect that by the end of the year, the end of next year, we will be taking off with a plant or two transitioning into construction, and a number of other plants moving in that direction, and. Once we get one built, because of all these verbal expressions of interest from around the world, we anticipate that the rollouts will be very rapid. And we've designed our organization structure so that we can maximize our speed of rollout around the world. And it is because we use off-the-shelf equipment and very standard engineering, albeit on patented processes, we can actually use local companies around the world to deliver it. So that will accelerate the transition and the rollouts globally.
And let's certainly hope so, because given the current context of the situation we find ourselves in, the need to decarbonise and the need to shore up energy security and resilience, it cannot come a moment too soon, can it? Mark, thank you ever so much for taking the time to join us on the programme today. It's been an immense pleasure having you, and as I've said, I'd certainly love to welcome you back, certainly to see how that technology is continuing to develop. And by all means, do take care and stay safe with all that is still going on in the world as well.
Thank you very much. And can I invite your listeners to read my blog, which is on the Store Electric website, worldwideweb.storeelectric, that's storelectric.com. No gaps, no dots, no double E's. And there are put in my relatively hard-hitting analyses of various aspects of the energy transition and such like. So thank you very much for having me on. I look forward to what you allude to, another invitation to join you again.
Absolutely, and I'm sure that will be forthcoming in future. And just to reiterate, of course, what Mark said there, I mean, it's a very, very interesting read, the Stall Electric website, and a fantastic page there as well to look at making the case for compressed air energy storage technology that we have discussed today. So please do go and have a look at that. And if you do have something to say as well about the issues that we've discussed today, do contact us via leaderscouncil, all one word, .co.uk/contact-us. You can leave comments there. But also, if you are the owner of an energy related business or any company and you feel that you have your own contribution to make to this or any other discussion that we're having on the show, then you too can apply to be on our programme via leaderscouncil.co.uk/apply. For now, I've been your host, Scott Challoner, on today's episode of the Leaders Council podcast, and thanks again to Stor Electric Chief Technical Officer and Founder Mark Howitt for joining us. Please do take care.
Thank you.
And goodbye.